bit for the ghosts. The exercises I did for the free field, meaning I want to consider a cylinder, be thought of as a worksheet of a string propagating in space-time, and I want to study the behavior of this theory of ghosts with this action. Now, the holomorphic and anti-holomorphic parts of the ghosts are pretty much decoupled, so I will mostly focus on the holomorphic ghosts. And you should just imagine that along for the ride, I'm doing the same for the anti-holomorphic ones. One first observation that might be useful is that giving the action without any reference to the metric is very convenient, but loses a bit of information. It loses the information of the stress tensor. So let me provide it to. What do I mean is that, of course, instead of the stress tensor, you could just tell me what kind of tensors are these B's and C's. But just to be specific, where did I put the stress tensor? Okay. So part of our objective is to understand the precise definition of the ghost stress tensor, which classically would look like this. And perhaps also the ghost number current, which classically is just CB. Now, these particular numbers, 1 and 2, are closely related to the statement that C was a vector and B was a two-component tensor. Notice that this kind of action can describe a whole lot of different systems. For example, if I was to write down the action for a free fermion, and I will do so at some point, I will get something very similar. But the stress tensor will be different because the free fermion would not be a vector field or a two-component tensor. See, this action is invariant under this sort of general transformations in principle. Like this at the beginning. Which are completely analogous to the transformation of the scalar field current. See, when I do the transformation, when you do coordinate transformations, these factors are holomorphic, so they are not affected by the del bar. They combine into a ds prime over ds. This gives you a ds bar prime over ds bar, and together they cancel the Jacobian for the coordinate transformations. In the case of ghosts, of this ghost system, lambda is minus 1, because C is a vector, which is the opposite of a one form. Okay. And so this 2m minus 1 will propagate all through our calculations. And course, if you remember conformal field theory lessons, then these 2n-1 are the conformal dimensions of the fields. So B has a conformal dimension 2, and C has conformal dimension -1. But if you do not remember the CFT, that's fine, because we're not going to use it. To quantize the scalar field, we expanded it in Fourier modes, and then we treated the coefficients as oscillators. We'll do the same here. Let me cut a couple intermediate steps. Remember, S is an holomorphic coordinate on the cylinder. Where sigma measures is a coordinate around the cylinder, and tau is Euclidean time along the cylinder. And the commutation relations which follow from this Lagrangian amount to these relations. This is a first order action, not second order. So if you look at the time derivatives, you see things like B d tau C, which means B and C are conjugate to each other. If C is a coordinate, then B is a momentum, and vice versa. And hence the anticommutation relations. They are anticommutation relations because they are fermions. These are Grassmann-Odd fields, to be precise. Just leave it here for now. So as usual, we could define a ground state as being annihilated by all the positive modes of both B and C. Now remember that when we were quantizing the scalar field had a zero mode, a zero, actually two, both a zero and a zero bar, and we had to had zero modes X and P, which did not create or destroy energy, and we had to consider a variety of different states labeled by momentum, which are eigen states for one of the zero modes. Similarly, here we have in particular a set of zero modes, B0 and C0. So when we define ground states, there will be a representation of the zero modes. And there will be two of them. Essentially, the simplest representation of an algebra like this, or the Clifford algebra, is that I have a state which is annihilated, say, by B0. And C0 acts on this state, mapping it to another state, which is annihilated by C0 now, because C0 squared is zero. So we can define some ground state, we call it G, and this will be mapped. This will be annihilated by B0. It will be annihilated by all the Bs with positive n. And all the Cs with positive n. C0 will map it to another state, C0G, which is also annihilated by all positive Bs and all positive Cs, but is not annihilated by B0 anymore. Instead, B0 maps it back to G. Okay? So my whole Hilbert space will be constructed out of G by acting with C0, with negative C's, and with negative B's. Now, there is another state which will play an important role in what we do later, which is usually called vacuum. Now, the fact that the natural vacuum is not the same as the ground state is related to the fact that this theory is not unitary. So the vacuum is essentially defined as B minus 1 acting on the ground state. Well, plus minus 1, I don't remember the sign. Or alternatively, the ground state is defined as C1 acting on the vacuum. So this vacuum has the property which is annihilated by all the B's starting from minus 1. But is annihilated only by the C's starting from 2. Now, these 2 and minus 1 are precisely the same 2 and minus 1 that we've been talking about since the beginning of the lecture. Why would I care about this ground state? Well, for example, if you look at the generic unitary conformal field theory, like the conformal field theory of the axis, you might notice that L minus 1 always annihilates the vacuum. For example, when you had a scalar field, L minus 1 on the scalar field, on the momentum state of the scalar field, was equal to A minus 1 A0. If P is 0, this is 0. Okay. So when we set up our BRST cohomology, is because B and T are related by BRST transformations, it's very natural to use a state which is Q by B minus 1. So the ground state has a better chance to be, you know, a BRST invariant object because it's Q by the minus. So it's Q by L minus 1 and it's Q by B minus 1. Anyway, it's fine to just keep thinking for now about these ground states. We also want to define some dual states. For example, well, we could just define a dual ground state, which pairs with the usual ground state. Now, in order for these relations to make sense, the dual ground state will have to be annihilated by C0. And by all the negative modes. So I could have called this C0 G. G tilde, let me do that. So here we have similarly a G tilde, which pairs up nicely with G, right, and which is mapped by B0 to a G and mapped back by C0. So G tilde will have non-zero pairing with G, and G with G tilde. Now, another way to state this is that we have a non-trivial pairing of this sort. Let me restore from now the anti-holomorphic zero modes. Well, I don't really need but let me do that. So in order to understand why, you know, why do I need this sort of sequenced insertions to make a non-trivial inner product, is really useful to remember that our C-ghosts are ghosts for diffeomorphisms, for ordinate transformations. And so the states that we are creating, right, states are things that impose boundary conditions that in far in the past or far in the future on your cylinder. So a given state in the ghost, Hilbert space, is implementing some boundary conditions for the ghosts. And the states that would be most useful for us are the ones that implement the same boundary conditions as the one we want to implement on coordinate transformations. So if I say that a state, for example, is not killed by C0, right? It means that somehow I'm considering a situation where rotations are far in the past are still a symmetry. Where I consider a translation of sigma to be a gauge symmetry. On the other hand, if in the past I had decided that I really want to pick a point on my string and call it sigma equal to zero, this would have been a less natural boundary condition, but I could have done so. Then rotations would not have been a symmetry far in the past, and it would have been more natural to use this state, which is annihilated by C0. So this corresponds to natural boundary conditions on the worksheet. And indeed, all our string states will be built out of this pretty much. Same is true for this dual G. So when you look at this expression and you ask yourself, why do I need to insert these two C0s? Well, suppose I'm studying this problem where I have a worksheet in the shape of a cylinder. I have some random metric on it. I'm trying to fix diffeomorphism invariance. And I say, OK, I'll fix it by saying that the metric on the cylinder is flat. Does this fix my coordinate system? Almost. It fixes up to translation of tau and translation of sigma. So there is some unbroken gauge symmetry, some unfixed gauge symmetry. And we saw yesterday that when we have unfixed gauge symmetry, there is a mismatch in the number of B and C ghosts, and I need to put by hand C insertions to get something non-zero, something reasonable. And this is precisely what's happening. So this is telling you, well, if you left your coordinates free to rotate at one end of the cylinder, but you fix them and prevent them from rotating at the other end, that has fixed the gauge completely. So it makes sense to have one here, to have a good correlation function. If you let them unfixed on both sides, then you need to fix your C's by hand. If you fix them on both sides, then you have over-constrained the problem. You have to have some extra B insertions to make things work. And indeed, if you put two G tildes, you'll have to have G tilde, B0, B0 bar, G tilde to get something on zero. So this is the physical interpretation of these ground states. Okay. Okay, so now we can compute some correlation functions on the cylinder, which should be useful to understand what is the divergence that we encounter where two fields come together, which in turn is something that we need to give a good definition of the stress tensor and the current. So now if what you care about is to just compute, find this divergence, it doesn't really matter which states we put at the end of the cylinder as long as the answer is not zero. So for example, I could very well put a G tilde here. Uh,
and do something like that. So, how do you compute these correlation functions? Run me through the steps. Yep, so let's expand in modes. Each of these C's either kills G or kills G tilde. Same is for the B's. So we will get a non-zero answer if and only if this is a positive mode and this is a negative mode. So that while you anti-commute them, you get something non-zero. But here we get something like a S. And furthermore, they have to add up to zero. So n is, has to be negative, m has to be positive, and they have to add up to zero. Should I say positive? Let me see, make sure. Right. So it has to be positive. If it was zero, it would annihilate. So I get, what do I get? I get something like e to the s minus s prime. Plus e to the 2s minus 2s prime, plus e to the 3s minus 3s prime, etc., etc. Right? Did I do it correct? Right. Oops. So, what will I think so. Let me see. Yes. So. Let me see. So am I doing it right? Double check me, please. So as I said, I need to get something non-zero at all. I need n to be negative. I got it turned around, right? M has to be negative, so this creates something, and then this destroys it. Sorry. So there was a mistake indeed. So here, the coefficient of this is just g tilde c1 b minus 1 g. Which is 1, and so on and so forth. So I might perhaps have gotten the roll sign wrong. Let me pretend I didn't. So this is a geometric series. You might worry if I did something OK. I mean, is this actually a convergent series? Well, this is convergent if the real part of S is bigger than the real part of S prime. When I order my fields like that, I assume that this was more in the future than this. So this works. So let me sum the geometric series, and I get e to the s prime minus s over 1 minus e to the s prime minus s, which I can write as e to the s prime over e to the s minus e to the s prime. So in particular, as s approaches s prime, this behaves like 1 over s minus s prime. Remember, for the scalar field, dx and dx approaching each other were going like 1 over s minus s prime squared. When B and C approach each other, they go like 1 over S minus S prime. again, I don't know exactly what you have done in conformal field theory, but I mentioned that these behaves, B and C behave in many ways like fermions. This is the behavior of OPEs of fermions. So indeed, this is just the Green's function for the del bar operator on the cylinder. So del bar of this is the delta function at S minus S prime. And it satisfies the correct boundary conditions on the cylinder. Because when S or S prime go to 0, to plus or minus infinity, this has a certain specific good behavior. Okay. So now we have the information that we need in order to compute, to define the stress tensor properly, or the Gauss number current. Do you have any questions first? So I'll define the stress tensor by point splitting. So this will correct it, will remove the divergence. Now, if I take a derivative of this respect of S, I get 1 over minus 1 over S minus S prime squared. So this gives me minus 2. This gives me plus 1. And I add another plus 1 to cancel it out. So using this definition, you can compute the Virasoro algebra. Although it's going to be quite tedious, you will find finally the minus 26. This, the fact that here you have 1 and 2 is definitely important in the calculation. If I had had some generic lambda 1 minus lambda, I would have gotten a different answer for the central charge. So in particular, from this definition, we can get the Gauss number, the Gauss Virasoro modes, the modes of the stress tensor. Let me use normal ordering, but let me warn you that this is normal ordering traditionally. And for convenience, this normal order uses the vacuum and not the ground state. So this really only matters for L0, but anyway. So this means that when I define this product, I bring to the right the operators which would annihilate 0. And then the stress tensor is just sum of n e to the minus n s. Plus 13 over 12. Okay. The same way as for the scalar fields, we go to minus 1 over 24. So again, this is another way the vacuum behaves better than the ground states. In a unitary conformal field theory, you would have found minus C over 24 here. So if we use this kind of normal ordering, this is indeed what we get. If we used
normal order based on the ground state, you get a slightly different answer here. 1/12. Again, this is just matters of conventions, but if you use the some conventions are more convenient than others. Now we can define in the same way the Gauss number current. Now there is a feature of the Gauss number current that I want to mention. So as you remember, the stress tensor is not really a tensor because of the Weyl anomaly. And this fact came about by looking at the subtraction. And if you do point splitting in some coordinate system, or if you do it in a different coordinate system, the difference between we subtract two different things which remove the same divergence and have a finite difference, which was actually, I don't know if you did the calculation. Maybe we, no, I forget. We did not do it. So let me actually do it. So let me review at the level of the operator rather than the zero mode, the anomalies. Let me start with the current, which is easier. No, I don't remember why I didn't do it. It's because it's easier to do it first for the current. This is kind of a cumbersome expression. So let's see. Suppose I want to change my coordinate system. So I want to go from S to some coordinate system, f of s tilde. So my Gauss current in the S tilde coordinate system will differ by the current in the S coordinate system in two different ways. But first of all, of course, there is I should have done it the other way. Okay. Was right. So if this was really a current, then this would vanish. But it's not. So why is it not? If I just look at the transformations of the ghosts, everything is fine. So when I do this calculation, when I compute this difference, the actual operators cancel out completely. So all that I'm left with is something like this, ds over ds tilde, 1 over s minus s prime, minus 1 over s tilde minus s tilde prime. Let me actually be explicit in terms of this function. So I'm really looking at df over ds tilde. And I need to take the limit. One over f of s minus s of s prime minus one over z tilde. S tilde minus S tilde prime. Okay. So, I mean, this is quite straightforward to compute. We can just Taylor expand, right? So what is this difference? This difference is S tilde minus S tilde prime
df over ds tilde plus s tilde 1/2 s tilde minus s tilde prime squared d square f over ds tilde squared, etc. Right. Now, this, now if I ignore this, this will cancel that. But if I expand to the next order, I will be left with pretty much with at least if I didn't do my calculation wrong. I end up with something like this. Yes. Sorry. And to remember, when you do this calculation, you need to be careful if this is evaluated as at s tilde or as s tilde prime. It will make a difference. When I did this calculation originally, I was careful. I think I was not careful here. See what what I really should have done was to use the correct factors that I would have used for this two. Right. So this ds over ds tilde was really something like d squared evaluated at s divided by ds evaluated at s prime. Sorry about that. But anyway, so you get an answer which is not zero and has these 3/2 in front. So this is a manifestation of an anomaly or this Gauss number symmetry. So this Gauss number symmetry in flat space, it's conserved, but it does not patch well as well as you would expect. When you put together different flat patches by coordinate transformations. As a result, even if it's in each patch, it looks like it's a good current, when you do calculations on a curved surface, you might end up with a mismatch. If you did the calculation including a metric, with a metric which is not flat, you would find that the divergence of the Gauss number or the Gauss number current is proportional to the Ricci curvature of your metric. So whenever your surface is curved, the total is like you have a total charge distributed over the surface proportional to the curvature. This sort of tells you how much mismatch will you need to have between number of B insertions and number of C insertions in the path integral on a Riemann surface. And from a path integral point of view, the mismatch that is happening is that just when you regularize the measure of the Bs and the Cs, there is a mismatch between some zero modes of the Bs and Cs. In other words, when you define the measure, you use things like eigenfunctions for this del bar operator, and there are as many eigenfunctions for Bs and C ghosts except at zero, at eigenvalue zero. There is a slight mismatch between the number of zero modes for
for the Del Bar operator acting on vectors or acting on two-component tensors. Now, the mismatch between zero modes computed like that perfectly agrees with the mismatch computed from this. This is an example of something called an index theorem, where you can compute the difference in zero modes of some differential operators as integrals of some functions of the metric over your manifold.
Mm-hmm.
No, I used a very bad notation. Okay. I really meant the square f over the s tilde squared over the f over the s. Now, when you do the same calculation for the stress tensor, either for the Gauss or for the scalar fields, you also find a complicated shift like that, although it's more complicated and involves third derivatives. And something called the Schwarzian derivative, which has a bunch of peculiar applications to theoretical physics. Now, there is a third quantity which you might care about, which is the definition of the Bierstadt charge as the zero mode of a current. And it looks like that. In practice, in calculation, we will never need to use the full form of the Bierstadt current. The basic property we will always need is that QB is the total. The total stress tensor, which has the scalar field contribution plus the Gauss contribution. Okay, now we have all the information that we need. Maybe I can make one final observation. Starting from this, you can compute the one-point function of the current. Or the one-point function of the tensor. So this will tell you the Casimir energy of this state. And this will give you the Gauss number of this state. So you discover that the Gauss number of G is -1/2. Which kind of makes sense, because when you have something like this, see, you have the two ground states, it's pretty natural that they have cost number -1/2 and 1/2, because you get one from the other acting on C and back acting with B. And it's also consistent with this, right? If both of these states have cost number -1/2 for the holomorphic part and -1/2 for the anti-holomorphic part, then I get a non-zero answer when this -1/2 and -1/2 are compensated by 1. Okay. And as far as the Casimir energy is concerned, pretty much from this definition, you see that L0 of the Gauss annihilate this state.
And on the other hand, L0, the ghosts, has eigenvalue minus 1 on the ground state. So what happens when we assemble all the ghosts and the scalar fields is that the scalar fields, Casimir energy cancels this exactly. Right? And then constraints like total L0 equal to 0 will involve, importantly, this minus 1 here. So when we did the calculations by hands, I said, OK, let's set L0 of the matter fields equal to minus 1 on the physical states. And now we see the explanation for that. The reason is that we are looking for states of this form. Now, something built out of the Hilbert space for the scalar fields tensor with a natural state for the ghosts, which implements the same boundary conditions as the gauge boundary conditions on gauge symmetry on the homophysms. Yes?
Could you have a state with ghost number 3 over 2? And if so, how would you get to it?
Yes, this guy has ghost number minus 3 over 2, for example, because it's obtained by acting with B on something ghost number 1 half, minus 1 half. The relation between these minus 3 halves and these minus 3 halves will become clear when we discuss the state operator map. So, all right, so I want to look at states of this form. And I want to look at what is the Beresteyn homology. So the physical states for strings are going to be states which are annihilated by Q, modulo states that are in the image of Q. Now, it's cumbersome to hunt down the cohomology by hand through this whole space. Particular, making sure that you're not missing any cohomology that has more complicated dependence on the ghosts is complicated. Is a complex procedure, and there is a theorem about it, a no-ghost theorem that, among other things, tells you that the cohomology is actually this form. So this agrees with the physical expectation, but is not a completely obvious statement. Now, if I look for cohomologies of this form, something nice happened. These states are annihilated by positive Bs. But if they are closed, they must also be annihilated by the commutator of B. Let me call this state V. By the commutator of Q and B, because B kills it and Q kills it. But this is L. So, states in the cohomology must have the property that they are annihilated by all the positive L's of the matter fields, and by L0 the matter plus L0 the ghosts. So see, this is annihilated by all positive modes of L so the ghosts. So we recover the analysis that we already did.
Conversely, you can show that this is not just necessary, but is also sufficient. So if you expand this BRSD current, and you look how it acts on states of this form, you'll find that all the contributions look like to Q look like Cn, C minus N Ln. And so this is sufficient to make sure this gives you zero. So this matter field must be a primary. Now, getting the other condition that we had, which is that descendants are trivial, is a little bit more complicated. So if you give me something of the form L n of the L minus n of the matter acting on something else, then your first guess will be to say, okay, let me try to reproduce this as an exact as a Q exact state by acting with Q on something of the form B minus N G. So W. This almost works. I can commute Q across B, right? I will get something that is of the form G tensor L minus N. But I will also get other stuff from L acting on the Gauss. So the correct statement is that you can recursively rebuild corrections and corrections to this expression in such a way that the right-hand side is this. So our analysis was correct, but showing it is, again, a tedious problem. To make sure that you can make these null states really Q exact. But it can be done. And so this way you recover the answer that we computed last time. So the states that you describe by hand, tensor with G, give you BRSD cohomology. And this is all that there is, pretty much. Okay, so this this is the analysis of the string spectrum. And now what we gained, besides checking what we computed, is that we have all the tools that we need to do calculations on a general worksheet. In particular, we know which, so in particular, we know which states to put at the endpoints of our string worksheets. Now, as I mentioned, in order to concrete calculations, you will want to be able to replace long semi-infinite worksheet tubes with something more manageable, and we'll do that next time with a state operator map. Now, how much did you see of the state operator map? Did you encounter it already? Yes? OK. I will still review it, if you don't mind. It's a little bit, the way it behaves with the Gauss can be a bit unexpected. Also, another thing, how much have you seen of the vertex operators of the free boson? Things like e to the I, p, x. You have not seen those? OK, excellent. That will be then a good part of the lecture. Do you have any more questions? We have 5 minutes. No? Okay. Well, perhaps I can start on. I'll just remind one element of the state operator map, right? So do you remember how do you map a cylinder to the plane? So which coordinate transformation do I do to go from the cylinder to the plane? Yes, that's right. So I can define a new coordinate z, which is z to the s. Then the past goes to z equal to 0. Well, the infinite past goes to z equal to 0. So it's a point of the plane that was not there on the cylinder. And then the lines of constant tau become circles. And the lines of constant sigma become rays. So the state operator map is the answer to the question, how do I map correlation functions on the cylinder to correlation functions on the plane? See, a correlation function on the cylinder depends on a choice of states in the past and a choice of state in the future. So we need to figure out how to encode this choice on the plane. Conversely, when I do calculations on the plane, I typically don't treat the origin as a special point. So I can ask, if I have a generic correlation function on the plane and no operators at the origin, which state does it correspond? Which state should I put in the past and in the future to match it? Now, if you remember the sort of answers that we found when we looked at questions like this, you will find that when you go, when you do this parameter change of coordinates, these go to the natural answers in the plane. For example, the Green's function on the cylinder with the vacuum in the past and in the future, go to the Green's function on the plane with natural boundary conditions at infinity. Now, if you look at the calculations we did for the ghosts. Here I give you the two-point function with these ground states in the past and in the future. If I'd done the calculation with the vacuum and its dual, I would have found a slightly different answer because this would have started from a different starting point. And I would have found e to the s2s prime minus s over e to the s minus s, e to the s prime. Now, when I try to match this to something that happens on the plane, I need to do two things. First of all, I'll replace e to the s with z, but I also need to keep this into account. The Jacobian, dz over ds, is e to the s. So the Jacobian for b would precisely cancel the e to the 2s prime, and the Jacobian for c would precisely cancel the e to the minus s. And so this will match precisely 1 over z minus z prime, which is the Green's function on the plane. So both for the ghosts and for the scalar fields and for any CFT, the vacuum is the state that you put on the cylinder in order to match calculations on the plane. If you don't put the vacuum, if you put other states, then you find something else on the plane, and that's what we'll figure out on the next lecture. Right, if you convert these, right, the answer is going to be something like z over z prime, z minus z prime. Where now I have a pole where c goes to b, but I also have a pole when b goes to the origin, which is just the kind of pole that you would see if there was a c at the origin. So we will demonstrate this fact. We'll demonstrate that if you put the ground state in the past here, then you should put a C insertion at the origin. So the state operator map will be the map between the states that you put on the cylinder and the operators you put at the origin. Okay.